Chapter 3. The List. The academic establishment, like the scientific establishment, is an in-group with a long list of opinions, attitudes, and beliefs, which, like physicalism, are not supported by legitimate arguments, and yet, like physicalism, are implanted in the minds of academic people so completely that debate is out of the question. These ideas are just parroted by academic people as if they represented fundamental truths that are self-evident and need no supporting arguments. Here is a list of the ones that I am aware of. The myth of the self-made individual. Freud did bad science. Carl Jung was a mystic. Ayn Rand was right-wing. Edgar Cayce, they insinuate, was a fraud. Eklal Kuoshana is thought not even to exist. Creativity doesn't exist. Intuition doesn't exist. Psychic abilities don't exist. Parapsychology is pseudoscience. The spiritual doesn't exist. Dreams are random firing of neurons. The mind is nothing but the physical brain. Prejudice against football. Prejudice against psychotherapy. Prejudice against hypnosis. Prejudice against religion. These things were communicated to me by scientists and scholars at the very highest level, including a Nobel Prize winner and a Pulitzer Prize winner. I can't believe that people at this level would take such prejudices and beliefs seriously, let alone allow their thinking to be ruled by them. So, again, the possibility of mass hypnosis comes to mind. I use the expression hypnotic implant because the word suggestion isn't strong enough. As I have said, a hypnotic suggestion becomes implanted in one's mind before one's critical faculties are able to deal with it. Therefore, I call a hypnotic implant, or one might call it a hypnotic command, because once implanted, it can operate as a law that must be obeyed. I offer the hypothesis to be questioned, to be tested, to be debated, that every item on the list operates as a hypnotic implant or command. These hypnotic implants are not rejected by people's rational thinking, because the academic community, like the scientific community, is an in-group, and these hypnotic implants are sustained by constant reinforcement from one's colleagues, who are programmed in the same way. I offer my rational arguments in this book as a way to break out of this spell, and I welcome the rational arguments of academic people in response. In September 1952, the day before we began classes at Harvard, they packed our entire freshman class into Sanders Theater and gave us official permission to use our own minds to think for ourselves. This was a great day for me. After many years of authoritarian schooling, it was a permission that not every college student enjoyed, as I learned later in life from a friend who had gone to Georgia Tech. It is called academic freedom, or freedom of inquiry. This freedom is important for the acquisition of new knowledge, but it is severely restricted by the biases on the list. It becomes freedom to think as they think. I began to understand this while I was at Harvard. People who were more savvy than I was got good grades by learning the biases of their professors. Yes, individual professors had individual biases, which might affect one's grade, but I had no idea that there were universal biases across the board that affected the entire academic community. Restricted academic freedom, freedom of inquiry, and could destroy one's whole social existence. After graduating from Harvard, I broke away completely from the academic community. I saw the threat of nuclear annihilation as proof of total systems failure, not of the technology, but of the culture that had created it. Because of this and other cultural problems, I turned my back on the culture and the academic community which represented the culture, and set out to design a new civilization, to figure it all out for myself from the beginning. Of course, I had the benefit of the cultural knowledge, but not without questioning it, starting with fundamentals such as, can I use logic? I decided for myself what was true and false, without asking the academic community to give me a grade. And of course, without really being aware of it, I also freed myself from the prejudices of the academic community. And then, when I presented my developed system to the academic community, asking them to evaluate it, I was met with a deafening silence. They didn't tell me what the problem was. I had to figure it out for myself. Innocently, unknowingly, I had violated many of their taboos. Or if you turn that around, you can see that in my innocence, I was able to go ahead and design a system that the academic community was prevented from creating because of their taboos. If the academic community was aware that their thinking was limited by taboos, and how much our culture has been crippled by those limitations, they would recognize the extreme value of simply being able to break free of that cage and think without those restrictions. That would be a major accomplishment in itself, whether or not such a person was able to design a great system. Credit the hippies. Credit a great many people in New Age pursuits. But the academic community, which defines and represents our culture, is not able to see all that because they are still locked in that cage. So how can they break free of this cage? I think the first step is to become consciously aware and to admit that these prejudices exist. I realize that turning my back on the culture runs contrary to the legitimate values of academic people. Even so, I think they might have stayed with me to see what this approach might produce if it hadn't led me into taboo areas. The prejudices against football and Ayn Rand did not affect me. I include them here only because they exist. As much as I enjoyed reading Atlas Shrugged, it didn't have the answers I was looking for, because it ended up with a world in flames. But Ayn Rand serves as a good example of this, of the kind of erroneous thinking these prejudices are built upon. Ayn Rand was not right-wing. Right-wing means wanting to go back to the past. She described herself as a radical capitalist. She showed in Atlas Shrugged in 1957 what Gorbachev was to proclaim 30 years later. Socialism doesn't work. She was trying to go beyond socialism, to the future, not back to the past, to design a system that would work. But I suppose to the academic establishment, with their bias towards socialism, it's hard to see the difference between being a capitalist and being right-wing. The first item on the list, the myth of the self-made individual, would block my work completely. It makes a straw man out of the so-called self-made man, saying that he didn't invent the language or write all the books, and therefore wasn't entirely self-made. But actually, all the self-made man is claiming is that he received his education, or a large part of it, outside of formal institutions of education. When I say I am Harvard educated, I'm not claiming that Harvard invented the language or wrote all the books, but only that Harvard determined the course of study that I was to follow. And similarly, when I say I re-educated myself, it doesn't mean that I invented the language or wrote all the books, but only that I determined the course of study I was to follow. After Harvard, in my quest for a new civilization. And that course of study involved almost every no-no on the list. Freud, Jung, psychotherapy, dreams as education, Edgar Cayce, and Eklal Kuishana. I developed my creativity, intuition, and will. Mental attributes thought not to exist. I had precognitive dreams. I literally saw the light. And in my innocence, I violated a dozen irrational taboos. Or should I call them sacred slogans or shared delusions? I don't have words strong enough to describe the impact these beliefs and prejudices and hypnotic implants have had on our culture and its hopes for advancement. Students looking for a liberal education and freedom of inquiry are instead being restricted by a quasi-religious cult mentality. The myth of the self-made individual needs one more comment. By closing its eyes to the self-made individual, the academic community also closes its eyes to what that individual may have learned outside the confines of academia. The head of Harvard University Press told me in 1970, "We publish books by scholars for scholars." The "by scholars" part implies people with PhD degrees operating within a school. It implies that the academic community is recirculating the same information and is closed to new knowledge coming in from the outside world, from people who aren't scholars. There are scholars and there are creative thinkers. The scholars preserve and teach cultural knowledge. Creative thinkers create new knowledge. Usually the creative thinkers are also scholars, but this is not always the case. I am a creative thinker, but not a scholar. I concede that the scholars have much more knowledge than I have, but also I have knowledge the scholars don't have, because I created it. It is this knowledge that I am trying to communicate to scholars for the advancement of the culture. When the members of the academic in-group recognize the limitations placed on their own thinking by in-group pressures, they will value more the creative thinking coming to them from the outside. The cost of attending Princeton, Harvard, Yale, or Stanford, PHYS, for the academic year 2018 to 2019 is almost $70,000. For this price, I think prospective students should ask what they are getting for their money. The argument that obscures this issue is economic. If you have a college degree, your lifetime earnings will likely be much more than what you would have earned with only a high school education, and the return on your investment will likely be many times what you initially paid for your college education. I say likely because there are exceptions, such as Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, but for most people, a college education is a good investment, and an education at one of the most prestigious institutions is even a better investment. This argument, of course, bypasses the whole issue of the quality of education. That quality is compromised as students are indoctrinated into a limited view of reality. They aren't encouraged to develop their full human potential. The economic equation can change as companies recognize the value of things such as psychotherapy, thinking outside the box, and the power of prayer in their employees, not to mention psychic abilities. Why aren't there alternative universities that teach this stuff? There are, but for the most part, they are ranked lower than the lowest ranked university, probably because of the same prejudices that created the list in the first place. I'm going to pick apart most of the items on the list in the course of this book, showing how they reinforce physicalism in blocking our view of the mental and the spiritual. But legitimate arguments are not enough. The academic establishment has power, power that does not come from the legitimacy of their arguments, but power that comes from the fact that a college education is a good investment, no matter what was taught, and power that comes from the fact that scientists are believed as authorities, no matter what they are saying. In our government, we have checks and balances to keep any one individual or faction from having absolute power. In business, competition helps to keep people honest. But the academic establishment, as one in-group, is in a monopoly position with no established checks and balances. So I need your help in opposing this power. I need you to question their authority. Every time they parrot one of the slogans from the list, I need you to ask them, what academic department is responsible for knowing about Carl Jung, Edgar Cayce, Richard Kenninger, reincarnation, levitation, precognition, or spirit communication, or for having demonstrated rigorously that none of these subjects are worthy of study? I need you to engage them in debate. And most important, I need you to refuse to support your alma mater if it is dominated by these unscientific and unscholarly beliefs. I have not given money to Harvard since 1966 because Harvard supports scientism, as I called it in my 45th reunion report, and I have told them about it over and over again. A few big donors withholding their money and telling their university why they are withholding it should have an effect on the power equation. Or better yet, the research that Ian Stevenson was able to do on reincarnation at the University of Virginia was made possible by a large donation specifically for spiritual and religious studies. So, you could apply this financial power in a positive way by specifying that your donation is for the study of the spiritual, or parapsychology, or the cities. Money is power. Money determines, to a large degree, what academic people study. The people with the money should not be affected by ridicule, and certainly not by threats of loss of funding. So, I hope you will read my legitimate arguments here and translate them into power with your financial support or non-support of the academic community.